welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 4.9. Come for Niagara, stay for Nate Wells, and stick around for celebration and jubilation. Feels wrong to like start this and not say anything about football because I mean, come on. I still am like trying to get my words about even what I think and I feel about it. I'm still hoping my voice comes back, so hopefully like this podcast ends up going okay because of it. I know I've been talking with a deep voice for the last couple of days. I think we will just save that and we can make it a secret segment at the end for you and I just kind of yammering and going a little bit off the hook if you want to stick around for that. But since this is a hockey cast and you are definitely here because you cared about the Michigan Niagara series, maybe more than we did, we will talk about that, kind of. So you watched the Friday game.
I sort of watched both games.
You sort of watched both games. I watched the Friday game. I was at Yost for that game. It was, I mean, we kind of like, we previewed it a little bit last week, and I couldn't find really any reason that Michigan should lose this game other than if they just started shooting on Portillo. Thankfully, I mean, they didn't really do that.
The overview of the weekend is like, Niagara is bad. Michigan's supposed to be good. They should win both games by a pretty wide margin, and they did.
Yes.
That's the 100-foot view, and that's the view that shows up in the box scores, right? So,
right. The 50-foot view might say, maybe they could have done it a little earlier in the games.
Hey, they play 60 minutes for a reason.
That's true. So now we'll come down to the 10-foot view where we're just hovering above the ground because that doesn't creep people out. The first thing that really happened in my first note is a 3-on-2 for Niagara that basically hops over a guy's stick when he has an open back door, and like 55 seconds into the game, Michigan's a little lucky they're not trailing 1-0, which was like the exact opposite of the way that I thought this game was going to start, but it didn't go in. And then pretty soon after that, Steve Holtz gets like ripped behind the net and has a centering pass, but thankfully Johnny Beecher is there to break up the pass and to avert that danger. The first 5 or 6 minutes of this game were not great. Like, it probably was maybe the worst stretch of the weekend for Michigan, where at one point I think I looked up and they had 3 shots and Niagara had 6. And spoiler alert, they ended up game one with 12, and half their shots came in like the first half of the first period, if that's a thing.
By the way, we didn't talk about this with Nate in the second segment, but Minnesota State, I don't remember who it was against. I have to look it up. But they held somebody to 5 shots total this weekend.
How many shots were blocked?
I can look it up.
75?
I just had to put that out there.
Okay.
Michigan held Niagara to what, like 5 in the second 2 periods? But the first got them 6, most of the way to 12. So.
Yeah, 7. It was 9-7 at the end of the first. So Edwards gets called for a trip and they go and Niagara goes on a power play and not a whole lot happens. Portillo makes a couple of saves, but you think no big deal. And then Edwards gets a really good chance going the other way, as he has the next couple notes on my sheet here, but it was, I forget who the pass was from. It might've been Hughes Blankenberg. Can't remember, but hits. They have a semi rush going up the ice and a nice pass between two Niagara players to Ethan Edwards, who's ahead of them. And he kind of goes left to right, forehand, backhand, and maybe the save of the weekend for Jake Seibel, who, I mean, we'll talk about him a little bit as this segment goes on, but he had a pretty nice game. I mean, they end up giving up a bunch of goals and maybe one or two of them he wants back, but I mean, Michigan could have had a ton, and he reached his left pad out. I don't know if you got to see a close-up of that. I got to see the overhead view, and the guy just got his skate on the post and just shut him down.
Yeah, that was a great save. I thought Seibel, I mean, you know, just the goaltending in general was really good the whole weekend for Niagara.
And then, as would happen, that he mentioned this in his post game, as I overheard it, where he said that would have been pretty nice for my first goal. So his first goal comes a couple rushes later as he gets the puck out of the zone and in, and he's kind of on his kind of skating backwards down the left wing and turns to face and sees, I believe it was Dylan Duke. Oh, no, actually – Duke, well, he got the puck in, and Duke actually made a nice play. You can talk about this, but it looks like he's trying to center it back to Duke in front, hits a Niagara player, and just goes in and past Seibel, who, like, has made every other save, but apparently it's not going to make saves off his own players.
Well, Duke retrieved the dump in against two Niagara players and then got it to the point, and so as a result, because two Niagara players had committed to that right corner, then once they get it to the top, there's a lot of space on the weak side and they get it over there. And then Edwards slides down and Duke, once he retrieves the puck, heads straight to the net. And then Edwards, using that space, slides down, puts it through the crease. And then it, I guess, goes in off a Niagara player. Kind of ruined my freshman to freshman tweet, but whatever.
That's why they have a delete button, Alex. So, that's kind of been a little bit building on the last few weeks with Duke, where he's making a little bit of plays here and there and creating chances, not always getting like the goal or the assist, but starting to make plays where just giving Michigan a chance on that line. And that's, you know, Michigan's blended their lines a little bit, but they've kind of kept the Lambert Duke Morgan line together as maybe the fourth line.
Yeah, I like that line a lot. I think they're playing really well. And, you know, you've seen in these last 2 weekends, really, Duke come on and also Mackie Samoskevich come on. And those two guys being freshmen, if you can get more from them moving forward, that's huge. Because, I mean, Samo has looked honestly like Michigan's second or third best forward in these last 2 weekends. Part of that is about Beniers and Bordalo not playing as well, I think, these last 2 weeks. But part of it is also, like, you know, his talents coming through.
Yes, no, I agree with that. And he can skate. So when you, yep, you're starting to see the different levels that Samoskevich is bringing. Late in the period, Johnny Beecher takes kind of a silly slashing call, I thought, in the offensive zone, where it was just not super necessary, and gives Niagara a power play. And I think within the first 10 or 15 seconds it was, they get a shot from the point that kind of navigates a few different players and beats Portillo. I don't think he saw it. It looked like he was moving from his right to his left a little bit, anticipating the shot coming from a different angle, and the puck just kind of went in back on his right side. It was 1-1. I'm not really sure there's a lot you can do on that penalty kill. I'm not really sure there's a lot you can do for Portillo in that situation. But my takeaway there is, you know, in these situations against a team like Niagara, you know, don't take that penalty.
Yeah, it was a very bad penalty. No way around that.
Glad we're on the same page there. Into the second period, then Michigan finally gets back on it, and as they get a power play, and then the most notable part is then they get a second power play within that power play. So it becomes a 5-on-3, which was really interesting to me because of what we talked about in the Notre Dame weekend, where they had two chances and really didn't look like they know what they were doing. This one, so they end up getting a goal on this. So they score on the 5-on-3, which was, I think, important, especially given the fact that it was 1-1 in the second period. But Niagara defended this kind of weirdly. They let KJ sort of walk right down the left wing and almost into the goalie, and basically said, let Seibel make the save. And so he's like down and dancing around, and KJ's walking in. I don't think KJ really expected that. I think he expected to meet somebody. So he's kind of turning and looking. He ends up shooting it a couple of times, and it's just right into the goalie. But later on, Blankenberg actually got a really good look from the slot, and Pasta was sitting on the doorstep and slammed home the rebound. So they did get the 5-on-3 goal. Did you think Niagara played that kind of odd?
If you mean odd as bad, then yes, because that was bad. You know, the approach to 5-on-3s, you know, generally is you clump your three dudes together and you kind of just put them like right in the high danger area in front of the net. Yeah. So the team can go kind of around you all around the perimeter. They have a ton of space to the outside, but the one thing they can't do is like drive the net in that area. The other thing they can't do is like make a side to side pass through that area because you've got three players right there. And so it kind of turns into a firing squad, right? Where you've got three guys basically just camped out, and you know, it has its positives and negatives, but that is not what you do. But Niagara had their three guys like spaced out where like two were playing like close to the dots or like the edge of like the faceoff circle.
It was inverted.
And then like
the triangle was just upside down,
kind of like high up. And it made it so that you could penetrate and you could pass through it. And I don't really know what the point of that was. Like, I don't know what they're taking away when they line up like that, because I don't know, you're just letting people move straight into the most dangerous areas and make the most dangerous passes and not visibly taking much of anything away, unless like your players don't want to block shots.
You mentioned that you weren't sure about KJ's decision making.
Well, yeah, I have to go back and rewatch it, but I think in that situation, when you're being given all the room in the world to make dangerous passes, that he was kind of just like, oh, there's space, I'm going to go try and score. And it was just like too easy, basically. That was my thought. But again, I'd have to go back and rewatch, which I didn't have time for because football.
Well, yeah.
By the way, I looked up the number on that Minnesota State game. It was against Lake State. It was the Saturday night game. They outshot in total, in terms of shots on goal, let me get the exact number here. They outshot Lake State 25-5, allowed one shot on goal in both the first and third periods. And in terms of even strength, they allowed three total shots on goal. They blocked 15. And they had 10 Lake State shots that missed.
So not even that many attempts.
28 shot attempts at even strength, and three made it on net.
Well, I'm glad I don't have to watch that all the time. So it's 2-1 now after this 5-on-3 goal. Brisson has a fun goal where he is laying on the ice and basically just kind of punches it in with his hand, and everybody goes crazy. And then they play the song and the horn, and I'm just sitting there kind of laughing because I'm like, there's no way that's a goal.
But I didn't see that part live because I was watching on, you know, the rafter cam.
Oh, yeah.
But then they showed the close-up replay and I just started cackling.
Right. Because it's there and it's almost like he's playing air hockey.
Yeah.
With the puck, and he just like throws it in, and you know, you're up 2-1, you're trying to get the third goal, you know, you gotta do what you can do. And then like the rest of the period to me was basically like Seibel like bailing out Niagara over and over and over again, making saves on his like down on his chest when he's on the ice. He made saves standing, he used his legs, he used his arms. I mean, it was a pretty good display throughout that second period. I mean, obviously Niagara didn't really have the puck and he just was, like you said, lined up in front of a firing squad, like it would be a 5-on-3. And he held his own for quite some time. I thought he was as impressive as anyone on the ice for that particular time. You know, Michigan had a couple of power plays, or at least one later on in that period, and didn't do anything. That power play did continue over into the third period, however, and we had a Bortolo to Pasta who got below the goal line, and then he hit Samo sitting in the slot, and he scored a power play goal to make it 3-1. Pretty well worked, nice passing, and not from the top unit.
I mean, it's basically these last two periods, it's just Michigan totally dominating at 5-on-5. Tilting the ice in a just outrageous way. And the moment they went up 3-1, the game was over. And it's not really worth talking about much else outside of just mentioning the goals, because there's nothing there, right? It's just not a game that you can use anything from, right? It's like when you're up 56-0 on NIU, like, okay, this game has to keep going, but it's not going to help us in the Big Ten at all.
Maybe we can find Andrel Anthony.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy Hughes's protractor goal, as I called it? That was unbelievable.
I had that on. I had the game on my phone at the bar at that point.
I see. And so you weren't.
So I was just.
So he tries a pass from the left side to the right side, and it is kind of deflected and bounces away. It doesn't get to its intended target. He skates around the net, finds it with his stick, and he couldn't have been more than 3 or 4 inches off of the red line, and shoots it into, like, I don't know how many degrees that is. I mean, 5 maybe, like, no, he had no opening and still found a way to get it between Seibel and the post. And I think that's what I like to call a protractor goal, because you need a protractor to actually find out how little of an angle you have. No?
I'll let you have it.
All right. I appreciate that. Brisson then had a nice play in the defensive zone, forcing a defensive zone turnover. And this is where it kind of gets sloppy for Cybele's. His backhander was, I thought, kind of weak and went under his arm. But Brisson gets a goal he hadn't scored in a little bit, and it was nice to see him get back on the board. And then Blankenberg had a nice power move shooting down the left side. And he had a backhander, short side, but I mean, that's the thing about him, and we haven't seen him do that lately, partially because of his injury, and then he's been on weird pairings, and he just got turned loose a little bit tonight, and you just see him bringing the puck in down the boards, and he's just so fast, and that's probably one of his biggest assets, I would say.
Yeah, I think that goal came with like 2 minutes to go, something like that.
Near the end, yeah.
2 or 3 minutes left. I mean, that was the final 7 points that made it 78 to nothing. Like, there wasn't really a reason for Michigan to still be scoring at that point, but they did.
But you have to keep playing the game, I suppose.
Yeah.
So 6-1 final, then Saturday night after we're all in delirium, Michigan, we put the game on, and Michigan's playing Niagara again, and this time they're down 1-0, like to a power play goal. And you said that the drawback to this is like you can't take 3 penalties in the first period.
Yeah, well, and they also had it so that one of like two of them were staggered, right? Like they were on top of each other. The
Yeah.
third penalty came only 30 seconds into the second penalty. And so there was a huge amount of 5-on-3 time. And then I think it was just like the Notre Dame game where the 5-on-3 barely expires and then the goal was scored. At least that's how I remembered it. But you know, you go down 1-0, and you know, this game was kind of sloppy. Like Michigan just was really just sort of asleep through the first 2 periods, and it was 1-1 right until about 10 minutes to go in the third, and
Yeah.
then the avalanche of goals happened. So
We're going to use that phrase till the end of time, I think. It's just, yeah, Blankenberg did tie it in the second. And then he ended up giving them the lead in the third.
yeah.
That's 3 goals in the weekend for him. I know it's, you know, Niagara or whatever you want to say, but when you, it's nice to see him back on the score sheet. 'Cause you know, like I said, he missed those couple weeks and he was in, you know, a couple different weird pairings, and now it seems like he's got his skates under him and is starting to score again. I want to say that the second goal had really nice passes, both from KJ and Brisson, to make that one 3-1. And at that point, like you said, the game was pretty much over. And for the cherry on top, Dylan Duke, who's had, you know, building moments throughout this second half of the first half, or the second quarter, quote unquote, of the season, if you want to go there. He had a nice goal on the power play after a couple of nice passes from Power and KJ as well. So a couple more assists for those guys.
Yeah, I had this game on the tablet while I was trying to write the recap and then trying to get the recap through the servers, right? It's
How did that go?
kind of like shoplifting, right? Like you find an item and you like stick it under your coat, and now you have to sprint past the servers and get out of the store unnoticed.
We're giving thievery tips here on the Michigan Hockey Cast.
So yeah, that's an adventure. And it happened again today to Brian, by the way, because so many people were refreshing, waiting for the game column, that the game column couldn't be posted.
Because everyone's F5ing.
Yeah, which I don't really know about F5 because I'm not a PC person, but I'm told that that's how you refresh pages.
A couple notes here that I looked up about Power and KJ is that they're both, Power, I think, is on an 8-game point streak, and they're both tied for Michigan's scoring lead at 23 points in 16 games, which is
Pretty
pretty
good.
freaking good. And they're both tied for second in the country behind Drew Warad of Western Michigan, who has 25. I don't know if anyone had him leading the country in points almost halfway through, but we definitely saw enough of him over a 2-game stretch.
Well, the Broncos are, I think, fifth or sixth in pair wise. So they've continued having a nice season, and you know, in a tough NCHC with some of the best teams in the country.
We will mention that Matty Beniers did get an empty netter. I mean, yeah, it's an empty netter, but like he's just having the thing last year, you know, we talk about this a little bit last year, and then we talked about it not being as much the case this year, but he was never really like the goal scorer last year, and they didn't really have one. There was a bunch of guys last year that had some goals, but he has really jumped out as becoming sort of a not only a playmaker, but a goal scorer in a number of different ways. And he finds the score sheet on with the net with an empty netter this weekend. I just a very impressive first half. I know he's second overall pick and the expectations are high and all that, but I watched him last year and he didn't look like he was going to be, you know, Michigan scoring leader or at the top. And he just kind of took over and carried them for a few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, Beniers' growth has definitely been nice to see. I will throw some bait to the analytics crowd by saying that Beniers is taking after Kyle Connor by adding that empty net goal because Michigan to Michigan guy, it's long been the argument of analytics folks that Connor and Scheifele both pad their stats by getting an absurd number of empty net points every year in the NHL. But
Trying to get out there and
I will say that actually Connor's numbers analytically are a lot better than normal this year, and Scheifele is still considered wildly overrated by the analytics crowd, but it seems like the monkey might be getting off of Connor's back. So good for him. Also, one more note on this thing. Dylan Larkin today, if you saw the Red Wings Twitter post, won the bet with Ohio native and starting goalie Alex Nedeljkovic, who had to wear a Larkin football jersey on camera today. So that was pretty cool.
Well, good for Dylan for having confidence in the team.
Yeah.
Well, that is what we have for the Niagara series. Up next, we will take a break and then talk to Nate Wells, who has been a college hockey pillar over the last few years. Got to know him a little bit at Yost. And if you're on Twitter and there's college hockey going on or Minnesota Golden Gophers stuff or Minnesota sports, he will be giving you some updates. So stick around and we'll see what he has to say about the national scene, the Big Ten, and his beloved Golden Gophers, who had another nice win on Saturday.
It's a good thing this is an audio show because that's a lot of words to fit on an on-screen graphic introducing him.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know? Pump it up. You've got to pump it up, don't you know?
Seriously, I am still pumping it up. Like, I was driving around this weekend and I was just playing the song on my phone in my car wherever I was going. And, like, I will just forever now associate that song with this game. It's just been burned into my mind. We have Nate Wells on the podcast. He has been covering college hockey, Big Ten hockey, Minnesota, kind of everything. I mean, I've even seen you talk about the MLS team. And but Michigan's hockey is going to play Minnesota Golden Gophers this weekend in hockey. And we wanted to bring on Nate. Nate, from your perspective, you are probably still pumping it up after what Minnesota did to Wisconsin. I mean, that doesn't happen a lot for you guys either. This was a perfect weekend for this podcast.
Yeah, I know. It's two fan bases who are be able to celebrate rivalry wins that they really struggled with. I mean, last time Minnesota beat Wisconsin at home to get the axe was 2003. They're playing in the Metrodome at that point. And yeah, I mean, since then, it's they've been blown out a bunch. They've blown some fourth quarter games that they should have won. So yeah, it was really cathartic just to see them win and be able to just run across the field and grab the axe and get like the entire stadium to rush the field.
Were you there in 03?
I was there in 03. Yeah.
Yes.
It was, yeah, it's sad thing is that that honestly, that was like the second or third, I think, game that like I'd been to. So it's kind of been a little downhill since then, but
that's great. So I met you like a few years ago at Yoast. We just were randomly seated next to each other and you were like the Minnesota guy. And I was like, oh no, you know, I don't know who this guy is or whatever. And we ended up just kind of talking hockey throughout the game. And you'd come, I think, one or two more times. So I've met you in person a few times. We saw each other, I believe in 18 in St. Paul, and just a really cool dude. And you know a lot about hockey and stuff. I mean, some of those games at Yoast, I mean, Michigan wasn't any good back then, but like some of those games were probably some of the craziest hockey games I've seen, because I think Michigan one time won in overtime on a face goal. I mean, just.
Yep. Dakota Raby scored that. I will not forget it. It's, it was also that weekend where I think Michigan came back from three goal from like a 3-0 deficit and a 4-0 deficit.
And that was like our highlight of the year. That was our Minnesota beating Wisconsin for like those 2 years.
And it was one of those ones in hindsight. It was the year that Minnesota missed it by 0.0001.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So that weekend and the very first game where Duluth won in overtime are the two that always like stick out for that year. Just because it was a weird year. But yeah, I remember that. They've had some weird games. Minnesota has gone on to win a bunch. I've seen, I think Michigan had like an 8-2, 8-3 win against Minnesota. One of the trips that took out the Yoast that I always remember because, Don Lucia, like, he brought in like the third string goaltender at that point, just because it was like, why not? And it was like, and that ended up being part of my story. And then like, he was just like, yeah, it's always great. And then like, he realized the quote afterwards and like stopped. And he was like, you know, it's not usually a good thing when the third string goaltender, like when you have to put in the third string goaltender, like it kind of sets up where the game's going. But yeah, I always enjoy trips to Yoast. I think it's kind of should be on everybody's, any college hockey fan bucket list. Minnesota, Michigan's always kind of really fun rivalry. Kind of funny, we're just after Thanksgiving, because I always enjoyed those old college hockey showcase games where Michigan's and Minnesota and Wisconsin would play each other. That was kind of a nice, fun tradition. Minnesota's kind of made that into their own thing with North Dakota now, kind of keeping that rivalry as like Thanksgiving weekend thing. So. Yeah, it's kind of just fitting that it's happening now.
That's a really good idea. I didn't realize. I mean, I knew they played this weekend, and I was kind of like, oh wow, you know, Michigan's playing Niagara, and like people are like, well, all right, I guess we'll pay attention to this. And then Minnesota's playing Dakota, and you're like, hey, that's a good idea. So you've moved right from Minneapolis. I think last time I talked to you, you were in New York.
Yeah, just outside New York City now.
So what are you doing now? Like, I mean, you're still covering Minnesota to an extent, right?
Yeah, I cover Minnesota. I cover just kind of college hockey as a whole nationally. I've been able to do some more national profiles. I did a couple of years ago before COVID went down. I went up to RPI and kind of just covered their big Big Red Freakout weekend, and just kind of been able to take like a 30,000-foot view of college hockey as a whole. It's been a little bit more difficult during the pandemic, but. I do enjoy the adjustment and yeah, just kind of seeing how just kind of the big picture of college hockey, because so much has changed just in, even in the time that like I've been following and I've been writing.
Yeah. So like, I think we talked about that, like you just mentioned that you follow more the national scene of college hockey. I mean, Alex and I talk about it every week where we try to find a team or two and it's like, oh yeah, this could be in Michigan's path or if they get this point or whatever. But outside of the Big Ten, and you know, we've talked a bit about Duluth to an extent because Michigan's played them, but who have you seen sort of maybe even out east that has had good years or you could see has a shot to not only make the tournament but the team to maybe make a run to the Frozen Four?
Out east, Quinnipiac is kind of the team that no one's really been talking about. They're 10-1-3 right now. They've gone through a lot of their non-conference schedule. Their one loss is to North Dakota. They split with them. They played them in Hampden, Connecticut. But what really just kind of interests me about the Bobcats are they've been a team on the rise the last couple of years. But they made the NCAA tournament last year, and they lost in overtime to Minnesota State Mankato. But they lost a lot of their top players from that team. Petrozelli left. Odin Tufto turned pro, and they probably more than about any other team kind of made the best use of the transfer portal, bringing in some big names. And it's kind of a thing where maybe you thought, okay, it'll pay off later, January, February, they'll get a team going together. But they're 10-1-3 right now. They look like they're the top team in the East already through November. And like, that's pretty much impressed me. I do think right now, though, it's the big story of college hockey is just Western dominance. I mean, I don't want to actually like get into the parallels because it's still November and
yeah,
things are going to really change, but you can kind of look at trends going on in the pairwise. And right now, 11 of the top 12 teams are Western teams. The Big Ten, the NCHC, both have dominant non-conference records. And these are things that are going to pay off for these conferences come March when you're trying to get those at-large bids in. I think Hockey East is going to be in trouble. Some of those teams, maybe that third, fourth, fifth team that Hockey East has regularly been able to get into the NCAA tournament. I don't think that's going to be the case. It looks like that might be a 2-3 bid league right now. There's still a lot of time to change, but there's been enough non-conference games where you can kind of at least kind of read the tea leaves of how those things are going to go.
So BU and BC are not kind of what they've been in years past. I know BC just like got COVIDed, I think, and they were supposed to play Notre Dame this week, or at least for a game. And that didn't happen. We were going to touch on that in a bit, but like, so those teams that you're used to seeing not quite at the level that maybe they have been at points in the past.
Yeah. And BC kind of going off the Quinnipiac point, BC is a team that also made big use of the transfer portal. So I'm sure there's also some, even taking away the having to cancel games from COVID and injury, just that I could see them kind of pulling things a little bit more together as the year goes on. BU lost a lot of players. You kind of thought maybe that they'd put things together, but they've kind of still struggled. UMass has had a lot of injuries in Hockey East. Providence has been a little bit hit or miss. You guys saw Providence in the icebreaker. They didn't play them, but you at least were able to kind of see them where. So it's a kind of a little high on them, but they haven't gotten the wins that maybe you thought would be there. And it's kind of just, as a whole of Hockey East, where if the conference doesn't pull through and you don't get the non-conference wins, it's tough to get those extra teams in the NCAA tournaments. Now it's kind of you're all battling against each other to finish as high as you can, and hopefully you're able to get those spots in the NCAA tournament come March.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of interesting. And then previously, like what you said about all the teams being out west. I mean, obviously we've seen some Big Ten teams, but and then Michigan even saw Duluth and Minnesota State, and they looked. I mean, I thought both teams were good. I mean, Alex, you were talking a little bit about Minnesota State and their goalie at a time, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows about Dryden McKay. Actually, one goalie question I had for Nate: Is Quinnipiac starting St. Cyr, because they got him out of the portal, didn't they?
They did. Yeah. St. Cyr has been their goalie. Yeah, which is, I mean. But yeah, formerly Notre Dame, formerly Michigan commit at one point.
Yeah.
So he's been the, one of the guys on their team that, has been, played well for, the Bobcats and, Rand Pecknold.
So we could transition a little into the Big Ten now. We could just kind of go through sort of the results. And if you have any thoughts on, we could talk about them so people know what happened. And then if you have thoughts on the team, you know, feel free to jump in and give us what you thought. Obviously, Notre Dame didn't play. They were supposed to play BC. Would have been a fun matchup, sort of like the old Minnesota-North Dakota rivalry. They've sort of lost that with BC, but are trying to make it back through these sorts of games. Didn't happen this year. Obviously, you've seen some of Notre Dame, I assume. They played Minnesota, had a little bit better luck than Michigan did. We just, for whatever reason, can't beat them at Yost, as it's been like 3 years now. Do you have any specific takes on Notre Dame? Alex was talking a few weeks ago about how they're kind of a different Notre Dame team, not the same sort of sit in your own zone, clog you to death, hope they goalie you and then, you know, catch you on a break or on special teams.
Yeah, no, it's kind of funny because Minnesota swept the Irish at Mariucci, and usually they've had more success against them at Compton. But yeah, I'm not surprised to see the Fighting Irish do so well. I mean, they brought in Matt Elijah as goal, as well as St. Cyr has been, and Ryan Bischel played for him last year. So I think he's an upgrade. He backs up Cornell to basically number one seeds. I mean, Cornell was basically the number one, them and North Dakota were the number one teams in the country when the pandemic shut down the season two years ago. So figured that would be a match made in heaven for Jeff Jackson. But I mean, yeah, they're getting quality offense from the Slaggarts. Max Ellis has kind of come out of nowhere to put up 10 goals. I think what he had a hat trick against the Wolverines last game.
Yeah, I think that was Ellis. Ellis did. Yeah, yeah. I think on Saturday.
Yeah, Ralston's taking a step forward in his sophomore year. So, yeah, they're getting that offense, and they're kind of in the matching. I'm still kind of waiting to see on the Fighting Irish. It might just be because the games where I fully focused on them were the games that they were swept on Minnesota. I also kind of caught that the game they lost to RIT. So it's like they have three losses, but I've seen four or five games of them, and it's not, they haven't had their best performances. So, but I, the pieces are in place there. And like, I wasn't surprised to see the results of Yost just yet, kind of based on Notre Dame's kind of figured out, Notre Dame is a tough matchup for Michigan. And, I mean, actually, I guess a little bit surprised to be the 2-3 on three overtimes. Cause I think if you probably looked at it, you'd probably assume that that'd be Michigan's bread and butter.
Maybe Garrett Van Wy was on the ice. So, then Michigan State had a bye. We've kind of talked them to death over the last few weeks and even year to an extent. But Penn State swept St. Thomas 4-1 and 5-1. Those were on Tuesday and Wednesday. I guess they tried to get those in before Thanksgiving. I haven't really paid a whole lot of attention to St. Thomas. Penn State didn't look great when Michigan faced them. Have you seen much from them? I know Minnesota had a little bit tougher time in Minneapolis with them, which was very surprising, at least to me, and I think to Alex as well.
Yeah, Penn State, if you're saying that, talking about Notre Dame having Michigan's number, Penn State's been a team that has found a lot of success against the Gophers in probably about the last 4 or 5 seasons. They did that series against St. Thomas to kind of just make a good trip out of it. It's St. Thomas is like about 4 or 5 miles down the road from the University of Minnesota in St. Paul. So kind of a nice thing to do. The Penn State welcome the new D1 team in. It's Rico Blasi is their coach. long time.
Oh yeah. That's a throwback name there.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense for St. Thomas to do that because, I mean, they're kind of trying to get their program going the same way that like Rico was able to build the new rink in Oxford and just kind of get things going, and build on a little tradition there. I mean, they struggled this year, but also they pretty much started a D1 program from scratch in about 8, 9, 10 months, and they're trying to throw in the deep end of the CCHA.
Yeah, but, I mean, it takes a while to get things going. I mean, unless maybe Penn State.
And also, so, I mean, some of their advantages, pretty much every team had the transfer portal. Like, they're able to get team players in from the transfer portal, but also they can't. Every team can do that. They can't compete for the NCAA tournament for the next 5 years as part of jumping from D3 to D1. Hmm. So there's a little disadvantages, but there's also some time to kind of put together the program the way that St. Thomas wants. And yeah, it's kind of, they were able to rebound there, Penn State against St. Thomas, who I think they only have the one win this year. So, I mean, it's kind of what you expect. The one win that the Nittany Lions had against Minnesota and Mariucci, they scored a pair of third period goals. They kept coming back. It was Minnesota, or they would score, and Minnesota would come back, and then they kept doing that. They're still kind of. I've seen some good things about the Nittany Lions when they're able to play the game that they want to. They found success. If they can make it into a shootout, they're happy doing it there. I still don't fully know what to make of the Nittany Lions yet as we hit December, so I'm kind of curious. They're probably the team throughout the Big Ten that I'm just I still need to wait and see more of what they can do. They've played pretty much everyone besides Michigan really well. It hasn't fully paid off for them in the score or in the standings, but I think they're a little better than the record shows, and kind of curious to see if that will pay off in the second half, or if teams are kind of be able to get wise to just the style and be like, we need to keep this close. We need to be okay playing 2-1, 3-2 games with them and just not getting those shootouts.
Alex, you had some takes on their goalies, because we saw both of them, right?
Yeah, I mean, I felt that their goalies have been less than the Peyton Jones caliber since they lost Peyton Jones, and that's been one of the big things holding them back, especially when they want to play that fire wagon style. And Peyton Jones, I thought, was always very good at making a high percentage of you know, good look saves. And I don't think they found that answer yet. I mean, it seemed last year like Audio had pulled ahead of Soulier, and then when we saw them, neither guy looked very good to me. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think you found like the worst game that Audio had, but yeah, it is one of those things where, but Penn State, yeah, they ask a lot of their goalies because they want to play the fire wagon. They want to shoot from everywhere. They want to be all on the offense. It's very entertaining. It can be tough if you're on your goalies, and it can be tough if you have a young defensive core.
The opposite of Penn State this year seems to be Wisconsin, who has lost almost all of their offense from the previous years. They hung with Michigan in a game that Michigan kind of gave to them in more ways than one. They played Clarkson this week, and I saw they tied 1-1. Clarkson generally has a pretty good program. Maybe that's a positive for Wisconsin.
Yeah, honestly, the big story, I think, if we're gonna talk about the two big stories in the Big Ten, are just the conference as a whole has done well. That the gap between the Minnesota Michigan tier and maybe that third, fourth, fifth spot is closer than we'd probably give credit to a preseason. There's certainly going to be tough games. I think both teams can kind of speak to that, where things do not come easy. And then second story is, wow, the fall of Wisconsin. The Badgers got the Big Ten regular season title last year. They were a top five team all last season. Obviously, they lost Cole Caulfield, lost Dylan Holloway, but they returned a lot of players from that team. They still had a lot of offense. They had the best power play in the nation last year, and they cannot score to save their lives. Somehow they found success against Minnesota and Michigan because they beat the Gophers in overtime. They beat Michigan. That's two of their four wins. They tied Clarkson, is probably the next best team that they played. But, I mean, they're swept by Michigan State. They have struggled to score. Their power play is among the worst in the nation. And the team that has, I mean, they have Brock Caulfield. They still have Tarik Baker. They got Gorniak. They have a number of players that you'd expect to kind of stay at that high level, and maybe, yeah, they'll take a step back, but I thought that the Badgers would take a step back, and I thought that they would take some time to figure things out, losing the Hobie Baker winner Caulfield, but I didn't expect them to go back from, they went from last to first. I didn't expect them to go last to first back down to last, but it's really, I'm kind of worried about the Badgers, which is a tough thing to say. In Minnesota, but it's tough to watch the Badgers. Just week in, week out. I don't know. We're kind of reaching that point where you might have to have those conversations about the Badger. Like, what is going on with that program?
Well, Alex, you were talking a week or so ago about an article in, was it Bucky's Fifth Quarter, yeah, about how they're maybe getting to the end of Granato?
I mean, the article was titled "Fired Tony Granato," so
he's trying to be diplomatic. But
the fan,
okay,
base seems to be pretty close there. I mean, for me, we talked about this a few weeks ago, but with him, you know, I think last year buys him a more of a window. But you look at last year; it was built off of NHL talent, and he's not recruiting that NHL talent anymore because Minnesota and Michigan are now getting the Caulfields and the Turcotts, where, you know, he kind of had that brief window where he was the superpower recruiter of the Midwest, and now he's not.
Ohio State played. Oh, go ahead. If you want to finish up with that, go ahead for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, Granato has shown that he is a top end recruiter. And they still got some great, yeah, recruits. Carson Coleman's, they brought in a first round pick this year. You were able to bring in Cole Caulfield. You had Alex Turcotte, you had Keandre Miller. But it's also easy to forget that they had all those players and Dylan Holloway 2 years ago and finished last in the Big Ten. And we're kind of wondering, okay, what is this team closer to that end than the team that won the Big Ten this past the season before? And the longer this keeps going on, the more it just feels like that it's a mirage that they played as well, like that they basically, Cole Caulfield helped them get to that point, and honestly deserves a far, far more credit than he got. He got a lot of credit last year.
Our football opponents of the week, Ohio State, lost to Michigan in football, and then also, I guess, lost to Mercyhurst, and they split, but they did lose to Mercyhurst. Who? Well, someone else had trouble with Mercyhurst this year too. Was it? I can't.
Minnesota.
Was it Minnesota?
Yeah, Minnesota.
They swapped Mercy Hurst, but yeah, it's the Lakers are have that high end lined. They got Danny Briere's kid leading the way. They played on the opening week of the season. It ended up being Minnesota's opening games because Alaska postponed due to COVID.
Okay.
But yeah, they had the Saturday game where they're down by two and they had to come back to win that one.
Well, so they also got Ohio State, and I think that the big story at Ohio State has been Dobish, right? Like, he's been like just kind of holding their team together. I mean, I think they're scoring a decent amount of goals. I was glancing over their stats. It wasn't anything that was jumping completely off the page, but his numbers are pretty sparkling so far this year.
Yeah, I'd say the two things, and they kind of go together with Ohio State, is Dobish and goal, and just the play of their freshmen. Honestly, Steve Relic has to be just like jumping up and down after the coaches picked them to finish last, because they got that giant chip on their shoulder and they're using it. And the way that the Buckeyes were going to find success this year, obviously, I don't know fully how much you can always make of that of last year being just the COVID, just a different year, getting players in, getting people to practice, being in groups. Like, it was a tough year. I think we're still kind of trying to figure out how much we can take away from last year that goes to this year, how much it shouldn't matter as much. But for the Buckeyes, the big thing was always going to be how quick they can get their freshmen in to play. And I mean, they had a really high end class of older guys who were drafted. Mason Loha is another guy who I think is a second round pick of the Boston Bruins. And it wasn't in 2020. Dobich was a 2020 pick. So they have these guys who spent the extra year in juniors that they're able to bring in, and they're right away contributing to that team. The three of their top five scorers are freshmen, and it's helped though. It helps that Relic runs a very disciplined team. They're defensive oriented. It's certainly helped the goalies. Whether it's Dobish, whether it was Sean Romeo, whether it's Tommy Napier, who seemed like he was there forever. but it certainly has led to a lot of success. The thing that's really impressed me the most of the Buckeyes, I'm not 100% sold on them, but they're winning these games where they're trailing and they're making these third period comebacks. They beat Minnesota, they trailed 3-0. They came back against Penn State in the third. I think they had another 3-0 one against Connecticut where they came back to win in overtime. And just, I mean, that's a tough thing for most programs to do, especially just, but one that is full of freshmen and full of young players. I mean, that speaks really well to just the job that Ohio State's doing right now.
The weird thing about Ohio State is they have four losses on the season and two are to Atlantic Hockey teams. one to Bentley and one to Mercyhurst. So it's kind of a weird thing to look at. One thing to point out about the Buckeyes while we're talking about this, Georgie Merkulov, who is their leading scorer right now in points, he has 11 points in 10 points in 11 games, 3 goals on 11 shots on the season. So 28% shooting percentage.
He's winning the Corsi Award.
Yeah. you mentioned that Minnesota game, and this, I think, transitions us to talk about the Gophers, because for that game for me was the stunner to look at the box score, because Minnesota out-Corsis Ohio State like 2-1. They get 3 goals in past Dobish and they lose the game. And when I look at that, it's either a catastrophic defensive breakdown or your goalie is bad. And their goalie right now has an .899 save percentage. So the question I'm asking you, because you've seen them play and I haven't, is Jack LaFontaine bad now?
I wouldn't say Jack LaFontaine is bad now. The stats are certainly, .899 does not speak well, especially for someone who is the reigning Mike Richter Award winner.
Right.
Has he come back down to earth, regressed a little bit more to the mean after last season? Definitely. Has he had a couple of bad games? I think that he certainly has a couple goals in that Ohio State game that he'd want back. There's a couple in the Minnesota Duluth game that they lost in Minneapolis that I know that he'd also want back. But he also has a lot of quality performances where it looks like it's the regular Jack LaFontaine that has been the Gophers goalie for the past two seasons. The defense, which also I thought would be a strong point for the Gophers this season, they returned their top six, has had a little bit of a struggle, whether it's just making little small mental mistakes, just trying to do too much at times. They had some injuries. They only have eight defensemen this season, a decision that I'm sure that Bob Mosco might be the second guessing a little bit with some of those injuries. But it's kind of just a combination of those where you see the high-end talent of the Gophers, especially in some of these Friday night games that they've lost. You also see those little mistakes, those little miscues, maybe just trying to do too much and just not fully putting it together. The Gophers certainly seem like they've been a different team the second night as the weekend goes on versus maybe the Friday, where they entered the North Dakota series. They were 2-5-0 on Friday and they're pretty much the opposite on Saturday.
Didn't they beat North Dakota like in the first game? They like crushed
them. That's exactly where it's going. Yeah. Then they flipped the script on against North Dakota where it was pretty much, it was a tale of two nights again, where the Gophers, I think, outshot North Dakota 15-4 or something in the first period on Friday, scored early, just controlled play. It was 5-1 and it was almost, it was about as dominant performance as I've seen from the Gophers in Grand Forks in quite a few trips for them. And then Saturday, North Dakota comes out and does pretty much the exact same thing. They give up the score 3-4 minutes into the game. And yeah, they dominate for about the first, I think the Gophers had like six shots in the first two periods before finding their legs and just kind of putting things together to make it close late in the third. But yeah, it's just kind of been that way for the Gophers where things haven't been easy. You see the talent, you see where things are going and where things can go. But now just the question is going to be, can they do it and pull it off in the second half to put things together? Or is this going to be Minnesota's identity?
So I'll run through my numbers. I usually look up about eight different things and we'll just get them all on tape here and we can comment them as we go along. But there, I know we talked about how pairwise isn't really relevant yet. And I agree with that, but I usually try to look it up. They're 12th right now, which is still not too bad. 15th in Corsi, which is, you know, top quarter. Not too bad there. 28% on the power play is, I mean, I think pretty much everyone takes that. And then the thing that was interesting to me is they're only about 80% on the kill, which seems a little bit low. Is there something on the penalty kill that you've seen this year that maybe, you know, they've struggled a little bit with? Or,
well, they've also played some of the top teams. I mean, their schedule hasn't really, other, you take away the Mercyhurst series, they really haven't had any easy weekends. I mean, I'm trying to think the next easiest games are Wisconsin and Madison. So
yeah,
I kind of there. But it's, yeah, it, I'm sure they kind of, they've taken a few more penalties than they like. And just, yeah, it's, I think from a defensive standpoint, which looks to be on paper to be a strength, hasn't turned out to fully be one this year. Kind of maybe some of the issues that from last season that you can kind of overlook with how things went for them are still kind of cropping up. I thought they looked good against North Dakota on the penalty kill. They certainly found some success there. The Fine Hawks did score at least in the Saturday game, but yeah, it's certainly something where I think a team like Michigan is, I mean, a team like Michigan has the elite talent that they do, can certainly, I mean, probably looking forward to going against the Gophers on that end.
They have 15 drafted players, which I may be more than Michigan even. And I think I counted six in the top two rounds, which, okay, it's no seven in the first round, but six in the top two rounds is, I think most teams in the country take that. They have four players right now that are scoring over 3/4 a point per game, which is pretty good there too. And then we touched on LaFontaine and you've touched a little bit. His numbers aren't the best this year. We know that they have been the last couple, 2.66 GAA and like Alex said, 0.899. And we mentioned that, yeah, this could be a spot for Michigan if they can get some power plays to take advantage of. What other matchups do you like for Minnesota in this series coming up this weekend? And B, like, are there specific things you think that they need to do?
I like Minnesota's depth. I think that is kind of their strong point. They have a lot of veteran talent. They have just been building on their past success. I think it's going to be kind of interesting for some of the young players to kind of have that first nice big trip playing against Michigan there. But yeah, you mentioned that with the Gophers having the six players in the top two rounds. I think pretty much in most years, like that would have been the story. Matthew Nyes, they met Chaz Lucius, who's been a little injured this year. He came back last weekend. Matthew Nyes has had a great freshman season so far. Tristan Brose is kind of his true one. But they were all picked in the top like 57, 58 picks. So obviously that's going to get a little overshadowed when the year we have four of the top five from Michigan. But yeah, for me, the Gophers are at their best when they're able to use their depth, when they're able to keep possession, when they're able to create offense. I think they match up well with the Wolverines on that end. They found success against them last year, whether it was we taking away the two games in Ann Arbor last year where both teams were missing their world junior players.
Yeah, there's like eight players missing from those two games.
Yeah. Yeah, so even if you want to throw those games out, I thought that, Minnesota matches up well. They both teams kind of try to do similar things. It makes for fun games to watch.
Yeah.
It probably will go down to, if Minnesota's defense, when they're on, and kind of going back to LaFontaine, he's had some off games, but he's been able to bounce back and come back. And the Ohio State game, he shut out the Buckeyes the next game. He's had some solid performances. The defense is kind of, when they're able to dial back and figure things out, they're really tough to score against. And Minnesota has the offense to kind of control possession and make teams pay and dominate on that end.
The thing that I've always noticed about them and that's given Michigan trouble, at least last year specifically, and Alex has mentioned this a couple times this year, what's given Michigan trouble too, is just sort of the size and physicality. Is Michigan generally, even if you watch them, there's a couple guys that want to go hit some people in the corners and they want to check you off the puck, but they just want to get it, pass it, move it, skate, and go take a shot. And that's something that Minnesota has prohibited them at times, as just kind of being bigger, stronger, older in a lot of situations. And, you know, the guys that Michigan has are elite level talents, but they're also not the biggest and they're not the thickest all the time. And when you go against those guys, especially trying to get pucks out of the zone and especially into the zone, I mean, it's a different game when you're having to go up against a guy who's bigger than you and he can remove you from the puck.
Yeah. And then that's one of the things I think Bob Mosco's done a really good job of. He's found the elite players, but he's also kind of able to step back and let them kind of develop an extra year or so and bring them in, or bring in, when you bring in the 18-year-olds, you're bringing in those second round picks on the ups. Like a guy like Matthew Nyes, who was a second round pick this year. I think even we're less than 6 months outside of the draft. And I'm pretty sure, like, if you look at it now, that I'm sure that if you wanted to redraft it, he looked like he'd be in a first round position. He's certainly shown why it looked like it was a good thing to commit when he committed in 16-17 to Minnesota, where it looked like he was on the upswing, and like he keeps just continuing to develop and kind of exceed expectations there. And I mean, he's a big guy on that end too, where 200 pounds playing. And yeah, for Minnesota, I do think it's kind of, finding that middle ground between, you get elite players, you have older players, and just, you need both in college hockey to find success. Honestly, one of the things I think Michigan has done really well, I'm a little bit surprised. I thought Michigan might take a little time to kind of put things together. I know Mel Pearson's more of a second half, prides himself on just getting the teams playing well in the second half, but for how well that the Wolverines have done, especially against tough competition. I mean, they beat Duluth in Duluth, the Minnesota State series, or sorry, not the series, the Minnesota State game there is pretty much the antithesis of what Mel Pearson's doing, where you have a lot of older 23, 24, 25 year olds.
How many people can we fit in our own net?
Western Michigan is a lot of older talent there as well. And I mean, they're scheduling teams that are kind of playing against Michigan's weaknesses. And I mean, they're finding success there. They're finding success early. And I think that really speaks well to where the Wolverines are. I mean, they're not the number one team in the nation right now, but I think you can make a very good argument that they are the top team in the nation.
Yeah. Well, Alex, you were talking about that, Alex. Go for it.
What?
Well, just about the scheduling and all that.
Well, yeah, no, but I was just going to throw in there a quick point about Matthew Nyes, who was being talked about a minute ago. I mean, he was a guy that when he was picked, I think 52nd overall by the Maple Leafs, I mean, all of anybody who really followed the Leafs was just going crazy. I mean, at the time, that was thought to be a great pick. And the comp I've heard from about him is a familiar one for Michigan fans. It's Zach Hyman. As a guy who can bang around the net and stuff. I just, what have you seen from Chaz Lucius, you know, as we wrap this up about Minnesota? But I mean, he was the one that was kind of fascinating to me, and, you know, he's obviously been hurt a little bit, but where's he at right now? Cause you know, right now Nyes is outplaying him. So.
Yeah. And part of that also has to do with, yeah, he's been hurt. I mean, Minnesota's forwards, they brought in Grant Cruikshank through the transfer portal from Colorado College. He's been hurt pretty much the entire season. He missed a good portion of the last month. Ben Myers played hurt for a bit. He's finally getting kind of healthy. And that's kind of one of the things that also has made it a little difficult. They've had a few forwards banged up, So it's kind of been a little tough to make a proper read on the Gophers on that end. And I think Lucius is probably just kind of the big one where when he's been closer to healthy, when closer to 100%, I mean, his shot is next level. It's fascinating to watch. He's been an elite talent since he committed to Minnesota like 14, which thankfully you cannot do anymore. It was one of those things where like him and his brother committed like 4 years ago, and it's like, all right, I will see it when you get here, because there's so much that can go wrong, and it didn't. Actually, that's probably the biggest surprise, that he's still that elite talent. He's scoring, skating, when healthy, he's really fascinating to watch. You're still kind of just waiting to see him kind of get healthy and show that why he is that top 20 pick.
Yeah, I guess any last thoughts about this upcoming weekend?
It should be a really good series. I mean, besides bragging rights and kind of just an early look at who's the favorite in the Big Ten, I think we're just kind of going to be able to see where each team is at this point of the year. I think if you told me at the beginning of the year that one of these teams would kind of have things fairly settled in and one would be kind of trying to figure itself out and show spurts of why they are a top five team and spurts of where they're struggling and giving up late leads, I would understand that. I would probably assume that Minnesota was the other one and Michigan was like they'd swap places. But I do think though, we're going to learn a lot about both these teams. And if Minnesota can score first and kind of be able to show it's kind of be able to control play, which I don't know if they can do that against Michigan. I'd be kind of be curious to see that against the Wolverines. If they can do that, I think that they should be able to take at least one of these games. If the Wolverines sweep, it would really just kind of speak to where Michigan is in the Big Ten and nationally.
Yeah, I mean, those were extremely the three games that Michigan and Minnesota played last year, you know, in the spring, two in the regular season and one in the Big Ten tournament, were extremely competitive, very high quality, you know, closer to NHL caliber than you typically see at the NCAA level. So it should be a lot of fun. Dave, you want to wrap it up then?
Yeah, no, that's I'm looking forward to seeing these teams play. That's like what you said, Alex. Like it's always fun watching them play. I always prefer them to play in Yost, obviously for those particular reasons. But when they do play in Minneapolis, like those are the best because of the ice. And when you get to see the extra space for all of this the elite talent. And I think the really interesting thing is, you know, Michigan does have the guys at the back end in like Power and Hughes, but they're more, I would say, forward loaded, and I might say that Minnesota is a little more defense loaded. So you kind of have strength against strength in those particular ways. It'll be interesting about carrying play when you mentioned the last thing that Michigan does have a tendency to do, and Alex and I talk about this, is they will give up odd man rushes, and they do at times have trouble getting the puck out of their own zone. And that's something that if Minnesota takes advantage of those things, you know, Michigan just hasn't been clean within themselves in that sense. And teams have put them under pressure, but There's definitely been some work to do there. And you mentioned Mel Pearson being more of a second half coach. I think that's one of the things, is that they've had bad Novembers and had struggles on the penalty kill and on defense the last few years. And then you look into January and February and it gets cleaned up. So it hasn't been quite as bad this year. Their scoring has made up for it in a lot of other ways. And Portillo honestly has played as well as anyone I've seen. I mean, Alex and I've talked about this where, I mean, I'd say he's had five bad goals on the year, maybe. And three of them came in one game against Notre Dame. So it should be a good time. I assume you'll be able to see the games, Nate.
Yeah. They're both BTN. So yeah.
It's easy. Hey, you don't even have to worry about BTN minus this week.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. It's good to catch up with you, man. Glad your Gophers won on Saturday. I can't root for them this weekend in hockey, but in the future, perhaps we'll do this again when Michigan goes to Minneapolis.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's always fun to talk to you guys and kind of catch up and just kind of talk college hockey show.
Great. We appreciate it.
Listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 4.9 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. Come back next week where we will have watched the games this time, sort of, but also one of them is supposed to be going on at the same time as the football game, which is a terrible thing and should be changed. And if it stands, we won't watch that game, but maybe we'll watch it on replay. I don't know.
Did you think this could happen?
Well, it's interesting because you went in. Number one, I had a tweet about this. I went to bed in a pretty good mental space.
Yep.
Also not sober, which is good. And then you wake up at, I think I woke up at about 11:35, 11:40, something like that.
Oh my gosh.
And
how can you even sleep that morning? Like, I wouldn't even be, I couldn't. Like, I woke up at 8 and I'm like, well, I'm not going back to sleep.
Well, I didn't wake up before then.
Well,
I just was asleep and then my alarm woke me up and then I got up and literally as soon as I was conscious and pulled up Twitter and everyone's like, Jamon Green is practicing and, you know, is dressed or what, you know, all those game day tweets. And I'm just like instantly stressed. And so then I tweeted that, you know, basically that, and people were like, you just woke up 5 minutes ago. And I'm like, yeah, I told a story last week about waking up at 6 a.m. on the day of the game. It's terrible. Wake up as late as you can so that stress is minimized to as small a time frame as possible, which was basically minimized to me walking to Tim Hortons and then coming back. But
so
anyway,
when were you like, not when were you like decided, but when was the first time you were like, I'm starting to believe this?
So the first drive, you know, you have that, like the first series is 3rd and 3 and you're like, can't punt here.
Yeah.
And then they get a pretty solid pickup and you're like, okay. And then they continue going down the field and then, you know, they get the Statue of Liberty touchdown and you're like, well, okay, that was really nice. It shows we have a good offensive game plan again. It's also the scripted drive. So asterisk. Also, we were here 2 years ago. I mean, I was in that booth. People were next to me hugging when Giles Jackson took it in. So I was already like, well, it's really going to hinge on this defensive possession because last time they went right down and scored. What do we do this time? So then you get the stop. And now I'm like,
Yeah. Although I was concerned when the snap hit CJ Stroud when he wasn't ready for it and he still gained a yard.
Yeah.
But she's just like, come on.
And so, you know, after that, you know, they hit the Roman Wilson pass down the sideline. Oh, and man. Now I'm like, And then, you know, you can barely blink and then you throw the pick and, you know, instantly I was just like, that's the stuff we can't happen. Because I went into this game believing basically Michigan had to be plus two or plus three in turnover margin, and
they were minus
and
one.
Executing at like 100%. Like all the game. Like I thought if they took one false start, they were done in this game, basically.
Yeah.
And so then that happens and I'm already like, well, that was it. Like you just can't, you know, turn the ball over like that when you're facing this team, when you had a chance to get points, like you have to outscore them. And so, you know, after that I was kind of like, eh. And then as the game keeps going, right, you hold them to the field goal, which was big, but then you have those two drives that go nowhere, the second of which was just, I thought, badly play called. And then they get the touchdown to Garrett Wilson. And so now you're just kind of like, yeah, this is how it goes. And then, you know, that next drive was the game, the drive that changed the game. I mean,
they've done that all year. They did it in the second half against Wisconsin. They did it in the second half against Nebraska. They did it against Michigan State, you remember, to get back after they gave everything up to State to get back into it. I mean, like, and they did it against Penn State. Yeah. And I mean, like, that's sort of the thing about this team is, like, you know, I was walking with Sue today at lunch and we were just talking and I was like, you look at this team and it doesn't seem like they're the second best team in the country. Like
we can get to that later, but
they're not like, they don't have the best pass offense I've ever seen. Their rush offense is good, but it doesn't seem like it's unstoppable. Maybe it is. And their defense is good and very good in ways, but not like, I mean, it's not like those 17 or 18 defenses or 16 defense 16. Where you're just like 16 and 17, where you're just like, oh yeah, you're not moving the ball on us. Like it's just not happening. It's not like that. So, but yet somehow every time they make the play, they get a stop or they get a first down or just respond to ridiculous adversity against everyone. And it's like, well, what can't they do?
Well, you know, for me, the fourth and one happens. They pick that up, and then you get the throw to Cornelius Johnson, and then you get the touchdown. You go up, and you're like, okay, we're still in it. And
we're like winning the game, and we're like, we're just barely surviving.
But, you know, you had 4 minutes on the clock, and that was instantly for me, like, I mean, I'm a Lions fan. I've seen Aaron Rodgers do that forever.
Yeah.
Where you score with 45 seconds left in the half and he goes 70 yards down the field in the last 45 seconds.
And then they would get the ball in the second half too.
So that was in the back of my head. And, you know, they drive down the field. And then again, I mean, you have the Moton pick that isn't. And that was another one that was.
Can someone give him his hands back, please?
Well, it's a chance for broadcasters to use the great world's greatest cliche, right? Like.
That's why he's a defensive back.
Yeah. But then, you know, he makes the big tackle and you kick the field goal. You go into halftime up. But at that point, I still didn't really believe and I still thought Ohio State was going to win because I was just like, well, generally speaking, like, you know, they tend to like adjust and they've got better players and we're only up one and it feels like we've got left points on the field and all this stuff. And then, I mean, those two drives to start the second half changed everything because you get the stick from Josh Ross. And then you get that next offensive drive where Corum gallops down the field and then you get the Haskins sweep into the end zone for the touchdown. Now you're up eight. And at that point it is like, oh, this is 2017 all over again, but like probably with a better quarterback. So we'll see what happens.
And a better running game and a better offense. I mean, that's part of this is just like when they were doing it on the ground, like that was the whole thing all year. Everyone's like, well, we're going to have to pass to beat Ohio State. And they did. I'm not taking anything away from that because Cade had, other than his one pass, he had a nice game. McCarthy had a phenomenal throw, by the way. But like, Michigan was built to run the ball and they did it against some teams and you're like, well, they're not gonna be able to do it against Wisconsin. Well, they're not gonna be able to do it against State. Well, they're not gonna be able to do it against Penn State. And then you come in the Ohio State game, it's still what we do the best, and they do. And they just run over them and through them and around them. And it was like, I didn't think they'd do that. I thought they might have some success on the ground, but they almost had 300 yards.
I mean, that's kind of the thing. I mean, I put it in my column because I was – or recap, right? Because I was recognizing this.
I see what you did there.
I know. Well, I put it in the editorializing takes part of the recap. But – that was the whole thing we said, right? When Ed Warner was hired and they finally broke the Drevno curse was like, well, if we had had a functional offensive line in 2016, we would have won that game because Michigan went up two scores and could not eat any clock because they had a bad offensive line, and then they did again the next year. And like, that was the whole problem, was that you've got this Harbaugh football mold, but like the thing you need to make the Harbaugh football mold fully optimized was like the weak spot of the team perpetually for 3 years. And now you have it. Now you have what you were always waiting for, because it, and it also works because the passing offense is functional and the offense like as a whole is a lot smarter, right? That like, the old justice for Pep hashtag is not relevant anymore because, you know, Josh Geddes has come through, and you're looking, I was looking this up. Michigan's got their best Harbaugh offense ever in SP Plus. They're now 17th in the country. And, you know, I don't think it's quite the same as the basketball where you really have to have a top 15 defense and a top 15 offense to win yeah. six straight games. But like, not having one unit that's really bad.
Well, they do have the top special teams unit in the country. I mean, yeah. literally the top.
Yeah. But that's the thing, right? Like those like Harbaugh's best teams where it's like, okay, we've got this great defense, but this offense is stuck in the mud. It can't move the ball at all. It's like really predictable. It operates at the pace of a snail. It doesn't do anything exciting. You know, they throw to this tight end who's fine for like 7 yards, and we don't throw to our jump ball artisan. Like, there's just, you know, and then you look at this game plan, right? All of the stuff was built on top of each other, right? The Statue of Liberty worked because you motioned Edwards out, who draws the attention of linebackers, yeah. and then you hit the other way. Yeah. Now, part of that was Ohio State's defense being coached like during kindergarten. Like,
well the tight end, linebackers are
the tight ends are on the right side, so the runs coming to the right side. And it's just like, what are you doing? And but no, once they went up 8, I was kind of, you know, really starting to think we had a shot. And then after the next stop and the next touchdown with the flea flicker, now it was kind of like, oh boy. And I think that's when I posted, I don't know if you saw my tweet where I had the text messages from different people right after that. And one was from my brother. It was like, boom. And then I had ones from different friends. It was like, here we go. And another one, it's just like, oh, Lord. And another, you know, it's just like a long list of messages. And that's kind of how it felt, because at that moment, it was like, we should win this game. And it's the first time all day we've been saying it. Like, if you lose this game, you choked. And that's not the way we'd been thinking the entire game up to that point. It was like, you have to win now. Like, you've built a 15-point lead. You have to win with 21 minutes to go. And
well, and the thing on top of that is like, I mean, the better team won.
Very much on that day, the better team won, no question.
But also, what did Ohio State do that they don't normally do that caused them to lose? They didn't turn the ball over. They didn't really waste possessions in the sense that, you know, there was a bunch of plays that they had that they didn't convert on or whatever. Yeah, there's
definitely no like, well, we didn't give the ball to Ezekiel Elliott the whole game thing. Well, right? No obvious just.
But Stroud wasn't airmailing everybody. He was just running for his life half the day.
Well, he did. I mean, they took advantage of that in the sense that Stroud doesn't handle pressure well. And so even in situations when he was not pressured, he pressured himself, right? Like if the tackle was being driven back anywhere close to him, he wasn't stepping into throws. He was airmailing throws. Like he does, when you get him off his rhythm and he starts getting scared, he starts missing. And that's what happened. You sacked him once or twice, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's not stepping into throws and he's not hitting his spots. And
that's who he is right now, though. I mean, in next year or the year after, he might be some all-world Justin Fields guy, but he's not that person right now. So, like, if you played the game again, you're not expecting him to all of a sudden be super mature and handle pressure really well. You're expecting him to do what he did. And the fact is that Michigan was able to pressure them and take away their run game. You had a great point when we were texting back and forth, and you maybe even wrote it in your column. I can't remember which all the things you said, but The best part I thought you said about the Michigan's defense was when they got set, Ohio State wasn't running the ball.
No, they had one run that was good, and then that was because of tempo, which whatever. But I mean, otherwise, and there's, you know, again, there's really no way to explain that part of it. Like, there's no way when Penn State and Maryland had some drives that were like, oh, they're kind of like running on us and stuff, that was a little disconcerting. Then to just go out there and just totally wipe them out. Now, part of it, I think, is that they were not rotating the tackles as much as they normally do. So there was less Jess Spate and more Smith and Hinton the whole time.
Some Jeter.
I don't think he's going to come out super great in UFR in my rewatch, but he did have the one play. So shout out to him. But I mean, otherwise, you know, I think looking at this game, Ohio State in 16 and 17, they get scared, right? They are the worst team on that day, like twice, definitely in 16. And then again in 17, minus the one position that's the most important on the field. And so Urban is like, well, if their quarterbacks aren't getting hurt, we would be 0-2 in the last 2 years. So like, we need to change some things. And so they go out and they get Ryan Day, and they totally changed the offense from the JT Barrett thing.
Yeah.
And then they come in with the great game plan in 18 and totally outfox Michigan.
Right.
And then Michigan's too slow to react. It doesn't make the necessary changes in the offseason. And we basically just get a replay of that game all over again.
I mean, they also had
a better defense
in 19.
Yeah.
And they just had, I mean, Justin Fields and Garrett Wilson were really, really good in 19.
Yeah. And so then I just think with 2 years off and all of the like recent memories to that coaching staff, it's just like, well, we're the masters. We solved it. We figured out Michigan. I'm Ryan Day. Like, I've only ever just totally blasted them. So all we got to do is play our game and we're going to win. And then they had a team that did homework. And I mean, I don't know if you saw Manuel Excel's tweet about how they ran from the shotgun every time they lined up in the shotgun and like just telegraphed stuff, right? Like, no trickery, no deception, no wrinkles. I mean, my scouting report was pretty perfect. Like, they did everything in this game that they've done in every other game, and there was nothing new.
Sort of like Michigan hockey.
We're
just going to out-talent you.
Yeah, like I said last week that they don't run the ball at all with the quarterback, but like Haskins ran it against Michigan in 18. Like, that's probably a wrinkle they're going to throw in. And like, nope, they didn't. They did no homework, no preparation, and Michigan did their homework. And so now I think the big question for, I mean, Ryan Day is a few things. Number one, all of the parts of the team that are not directly him were terrible. Like, he coaches wide receivers and quarterbacks, and everything else was bad. Like, their offensive line got manhandled.
Yeah.
The running game couldn't do anything as a whole.
But Henderson,
their entire defense was just a meltdown. Like, they were exploited by their weaknesses, but those weaknesses are there. And apparently no one's coaching the linebackers. No one's coaching the corners how to get off blocks or tackle. And I don't know what's going on with that. And so they can out-talent everybody to 10 or 11 wins a year, but two straight years they've shown up against a team that has talent, that is good, and that did homework, and they've been ripped apart. Like, it happened against Bama, and then it happened again here.
I mean, but that Bama team is like...
But this is Ohio State. They expect to win national titles, and if you're getting ripped up by the only really good team you play each year, that's not good enough. Like, let's be frank, that isn't. And so they have to figure out...
So what do you do then?
They need to get better coaches, and I don't know if they're able to find that, but like, I would expect most of that defensive staff to not be there.
Even Larry Johnson?
I bet he stays because he has to, even though his defensive line got smacked. I mean, just smacked.
But maybe they got beat because they're not as good.
Maybe. I mean,
that's the interesting thing about this to me too, is, I mean, 2 years ago in 19 and even a little bit in 18, Michigan had an NFL offensive line. This year, we don't really know. We knew Ruiz was going to go to the draft. You knew that, like, Bredesen probably had some draft ability, and on Wenyu, if he could, you know, keep his weight in check and everything, was going to be good. Now he's like really good with the Patriots, and they had nice tackles as well. I mean, what was it? It was Mayfield, right? He was in 19. And then Runyon had a nice 19 too. But this team, you don't know. I mean, they have guys that are well, like, other than Vistaris.
I mean, right now, there's nobody pounding down the door to take Ryan Hayes. I mean, that I've heard.
Nope. And the same with Stuber. He's kind of been there for, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Well, Stuber's like 60 years old now. So
he somehow passed me in age.
Yeah, he's been around forever.
And then, you know, Keegan never really got any play, a whole lot of play. I don't know if he played last year. I don't really count last year, but like, he's just been hurt a little bit this year. Zinter looked up and down. I mean, everyone was kind of like
Keegan and Zinter have both been really good when they've been healthy. It's just like they've had to play Filionga, and Barnhart did not go well when they had to use him.
Yeah.
So the injuries at guard have been a factor. But I mean, Seth came to me today and was tweeting at me and was like, I don't know, you overestimated their defensive tackles or whatever. And I was like, well, okay. I was very clear that it was Haskell Garrett was the guy I thought was good, who was bad in this game and was just totally obliterated. But I was pretty mean to the defensive tackle. I mean, I called
the other one. You called him guys.
I called him Carlo Kemp. And the thing about Carlo Kemp was Carlo Kemp can beat a lot of teams. But remember when we played Wisconsin with him as a starter, didn't go very well a lot of times.
He ended up 10 yards downfield.
Like, he was a guy that could get doubled and could be moved by a good offensive line. And Michigan had a good offensive line in this game, and they hit those guys with doubles. I mean, that one touchdown where they had the overhead view, the one before the not even trying touchdown, it looks like they're not even trying. I mean, the tackles get moved 5 yards downfield with two doubles, and the linebackers can't see the hole. I mean, the linebackers just run into the line, and
I mean, the linebackers, yes, but the defensive tackle, your defensive tackle is getting moved back five yards or whatever. That's not coaching.
Not necessarily.
You're just not good enough.
Well, and they're, I mean
Michigan's
guys,
been there.
Yeah. And those guys were, I mean, of course, it's Ohio State. They were all pretty highly rated guys. Some of them were guys Michigan wanted.
Yeah.
And I don't really know what's going on with that. And I mean, we didn't hear from Tyreek Smith or Zach Harrison at all in this game. I mean, they had like one pressure.
Harrison's been a little like not lived up to his top 10, top
He's still thought million. Of as a like a second to third round guy. I mean, I think he was like 50
this
something
year?
On PFF's draft board. Yeah, just came
Doesn't
out
he have
today.
Like three sacks.
Well, him and Smith, both their counting numbers have been worse than their like advanced
in their,
numbers
in their play. Okay,
but they were irrelevant in this game.
I thought
completely irrelevant.
You had the best thing that you said to me the other day, where you said that Aiden Hutchinson is what we thought Rashawn Gary was going to be.
Yep,
and that was pretty spot on.
I mean, we thought Rashawn Gary was going to be Ndamukong Suh, but a defensive end. And he was just like really good.
Yeah, he was really good. And he's good in the NFL. I mean, he's been playing well with the Packers. But Hutchinson, I mean, you know, I remember when he was a sophomore, I think that was 19, and he was like, I'm going to be an All-American here. And I was like, I mean, it's not that I didn't believe him, but I'm like, that's like, I mean, Michigan doesn't have many all Americans anymore. You know, I mean, there was times when they used to have, you know, you just a line of guys in one position or another. And it's, they've had good players, really good players, first round picks, but all American is something else. So you're the best player at your position. And so when he sort of said that, I was like, okay, man, you know, let's see. And like, holy cow. Like he came back this year and I was like, he'll be good. I mean, you had another good point about that, where he had probably the second best defensive season that any of us can remember. I mean, Craig can probably come up with 10 guys that.
I mean, he's the best I can remember because I was born 2 years after Charles Woodson.
But I mean, you knew that Woodson had the best defensive season in Michigan. So, I mean, that's clear. It, you know, Brandon Graham was good, I mentioned, and Maurice Hurst, but like Hutchinson just.
It doesn't
hurt to have Ojabo on the other side, though.
No, it doesn't. But also, by the way, this is an underrated point that no one's talking about. But why was Ohio State not doubling Hutchinson or Ojabo or both? Like, at some point, you needed to chip them or do something. And they're like, nope, we're winding up five wide or four wide, and Henderson's going to run a route, and he's not going to pass protect.
Yep.
And it was just the whole game plan, and the reason Ohio State lost was the height of hubris, was the belief that they were an indestructible Death Star, and as long as they played their game, there was no way anyone could touch them. And
isn't that basically what we've said about Ohio State, is like the two things that can bring them down are Ohio State and some weird out exterior scandal?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, they expected to roll in there and have, you know, Petit Frere and DeJuan Jones hold their own at the very least, but certainly not, you know, mitigate the problems. And they were just totally outfoxed, you know, and that's what I said when I was doing a sort of preview in FIFA film last week, was like, this is the one position on the field where Michigan can out talent Ohio State. And like, it's going to need to happen. And then it didn't. And, you know, I mean,
The interesting thing then becomes, you know, what, like, that's a good point you bring up about Day and the game plan, because then it's, you know, where is this a thing that can become, you know, not just a one-off? Like, can Michigan now compete at this level, assuming they can get, you know, quarterback play and line play and stuff? I mean, can they beat this team? Not every year. I'm not talking about they're going to go on an 8-year run or something, but can they hold their own and it becomes a rivalry in a game again? Or is this just a blip?
If you believe that Harbaugh has righted the ship and he's back to where he was, you look at the trajectory of the tenure. I mean, let's be real. This should be 2-4 at least. And if you believe he's getting more consistent quarterback play going on, then, like, you should have won 17 too. Like, Harbaugh, you know, the last two results were catastrophes. Right. But, like, in his tenure, he should be 2-4. And if anybody but John O'Connor is playing, he should be 3-3. So, like, you know, Ohio State keeps changing. Michigan keeps changing. Michigan was too slow to adjust to Ryan Day arriving. And Urban was just lucky to get off scot-free for being too late to adjust to Don Brown. And so now that's how the rivalry works. It's about adjustments and stuff. And, like, I've always, you know, there's no reason it shouldn't be Auburn, Alabama, right? Where, like, one team's probably the better program, but the other team does win, like, every couple of years.
I mean, I think the thing also is that, and that he doesn't get enough credit for, because I just think the media in general is unfair to him, and people in their narratives are idiotic. But, I mean, he pretty much beats everybody else. I mean, yeah. He has winning records, I believe, against Penn State, and I think it's 500. Maybe he's +1 against Wisconsin. And if you throw out last year, he definitely has a winning record against Wisconsin. And then, you know, Michigan
State. 3-4 against Michigan State, but one of them is a play that you cannot.
Another one was a rain possibly catastrophe with, like, John O'Korn. Yeah. And then this one, the Big Ten apologized for. So, like, I mean, we're not talking about how Michigan beat Michigan State 44-10 or whatever in 19 or in 18 where they dominated them, or in 16 where they dominated them. Michigan State hasn't dominated Michigan under Harbaugh. They've gotten lucky two and a half times.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's sort of the point, is that, like, okay, you can say he's 50-50 against Notre Dame. No one's saying anything about that. And they crushed him the last time they faced. Michigan had a chance to win if they had decent quarterbacking or a left tackle in the first game. And in the second game, he pounded him into the ground. And, like, there's so many things that if you really want to look for them are positives, but people get hung up on these, like, pie in the sky stuff, and without an understanding reality that it's just,
well, here's why I think Saturday is so important, for obvious reasons, but also just
because you talked to Damani Jackson.
Because, you know, it's because a win on Saturday moves Michigan up in a way that is irrefutable above Penn State and above Wisconsin. Because the argument has always been, and this was an argument made, it's always been a dumb argument in my mind because I'm smarter at sports than a lot of people or whatever. I don't know. But
tell us what you really think.
it's a dumb argument, but it was made after the Franklin extension by some knucklehead on Twitter who was like, Franklin's a better coach than Harbaugh because he also doesn't beat Ohio State, but he at least wins bowl games, and he's gotten to 11 wins, and you know, he plays Ohio State closer in average margin of loss. And so there was this belief that Wisconsin, Penn State, and Michigan were on this same tier, and because none of them can beat Ohio State, we have to find other metrics to evaluate them. And for various reasons, Harbaugh does worse on those arbitrary metrics than those other coaches, like losing the Citrus Bowl or whatever. But the thing is, those arbitrary metrics only matter if you've never been to the playoff. That's it. They only matter. You only care about that stuff if you haven't beaten Ohio State in a way that isn't incredibly fluky and you've been to the playoff. And Wisconsin has not beaten Ohio State since Harbaugh's been there. Penn State did it once on a blocked field goal. Neither of them have gotten to the playoff. If Michigan wins this game, they will have beaten Ohio State in a real manner and will have made the playoff. And that will elevate the program in a way that is irrefutable. Like, it's you can't say, oh, well, blah, 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 blah. We did beat Ohio State, but the ref's job does blah, blah, blah. It's we beat Ohio State and we made the playoff and we won the Big Ten. End of story. It all happened. We all saw it. And you can't argue it.
By the way, we're bringing back 18 starters next year. I mean, you're right. You're exactly right. And in that way, the Iowa game is a bigger game than the Ohio State game.
Well, Harbaugh had the good analogy the other day, or I don't know, yesterday. There's only been 2 days since it, but
it feels like it's been forever.
Where he said that this is the miracle on ice, where Michigan just beat the Soviet Union, and now they have to beat Finland to get the gold medal. So
I love coaches and sports people who know other sports history. Like when you can get like a tennis player in a press conference and he's like starting to talk about like the hockey game he watched or how he was up late last night because the World Series was on. Like that's the stuff where I'm like, yes, because like when you play sports, like part of it that you love about it is not just like, oh, I like basketball or I like golf or whatever it is. It's the competition. It's the understanding of the athletics. It's like one thing is different, but kind of the same as the other. And when you can appreciate them across the board like that, there's just something about that to me that is just sort of takes somebody's understanding to a different level.
Yeah, I'd agree. And, you know, this is also why it was so huge that Minnesota won that game, because I was sitting there kind of terrified, like, well, we just won like the big game, but now we have another big game against a team that's playing really well, that has a great defense, that has a rushing game that's come on. Like Mertz, just watching that game, was playing better than earlier in the season. And so I was just like
saying a whole lot,
man, yeah. Like Wisconsin, we'd probably beat them, but it would be like pulling teeth and it would be really tense. And if you don't show up, you might lose. And now again, you can lose to Iowa if you don't show up, but I haven't done my watch of their film, but I've seen enough of their games just in passing and looked at their schedule.
Yeah. Winning this game,
Wisconsin,
winning this game, the Iowa State and fan inside of me is going to be kind of happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you look at this Iowa team, they cannot move the ball. They are averaging under 300 yards of offense per game.
Like, they didn't know who their quarterback was going to be.
They still don't know who their quarterback's going to be.
I still think it's going to be Tyler Goodson in a Wildcat. I mean, that makes as much sense as any.
I mean, they've got a great defense, allegedly, but they haven't played any offenses. I mean, I was looking this up. Their best offenses they played are Iowa State, and that was like a year ago, right? Like, I mean, that start of the season is forever ago. And yep. Wisconsin, who can run it but can't pass. Nebraska.
Well, they played Purdue and got dissected.
Yes. And Nebraska, who can't pass protect at all and yep. can't really run. I mean, this is a game you should win. Just don't turn it over five times and you should win. Like, that's how Iowa gets you.
And this is the game where it's like, I'm glad this isn't a weather game. Like, yes. I wanted a little bit of the weather game against Ohio State, maybe in some ways, although it didn't seem to affect them too much. Maybe some of Stroud's throws were higher, although Michigan was able to run the ball better. So, you know, Reggie Bush mentioned that 1,500 times on my rewatch of about at halftime and pregame, postgame. But this is a game where you're like, all right, let's just take all the conditions out of it. We're going to put so many Michigan fans in there that are going to pay $700 for a ticket because it's going to be
like 80-20, I would guess. Yeah. It might be higher or less Michigan than you think because Iowa fans travel really, 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 really well. But
yeah, but are they going? But they're also going to spend $700 for a ticket for this
kicker,
game,
right?
And then you're going to say, okay, who's the better team? And I mean, yeah, anything can happen. It's one game, and I've seen five turnover games before. But, you know, there's just – you know, Cade said this in his post game, where he's like, there's something different about this team. And I'm like, that's the best way to explain it.
Feels that way. Because,
I mean, we've talked about all year, you know, previous Michigan teams don't win this game, or they don't, you know, this – whatever. And there's – this team just feels almost – it's not like even a team of – destiny. It's more of a team.
No, team of destiny is when you're getting weird stuff to happen. Right? Team of destiny is when
trouble
with the snap and Urban Meyer falling asleep at the wheel happen in the same year, or the prayer at Jordan Hare and the kick six happen in the same year. That's the team of destiny.
I mean, we'll wrap this up in a second here, but like, I would argue that Michigan got unlucky on Saturday and still won. They had Ohio State fumbled three times, including three horrendous snaps, and ended up with like minus 2 yards because, and that was like the third time that Stroud tried to recover that fumble. He like drops it and then he jumps on it and falls out and he jumps on it and has to like roll around and all of Michigan's players can't get to the ball. And then the one that snaps behind him, he like runs around and it bounces up to him and he picks it up and almost makes a completion. Like, come on, you do that four times and you get sacked two of them, three of them.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you that. I don't think any of the circus catches really qualify as luck just because,
I'm not counting those.
If Kakoa Crawford is making that catch, that's probably luck. But when it's those guys making that catch, that's also just who they are. So.
No, I'm not talking about that. That's just skill. I mean, the Moten drop and then the three snaps. Or the three fumbles.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Kincaid kind of rushing that read and forcing the ball to Wilson when he has Edwards walking in the end zone and that kind of stuff. That's like, you know, and Michigan had a couple penalties of their own. It wasn't like Ohio State, you know, they had a bunch of penalties. They did. But Michigan, you know, all had that false start. And
yeah, that false start in the end doesn't make any difference because Michigan picked up that series.
They did.
And I mean, it's really like the only two things that were bad was the Cade interception, which really hurts because every other player on that play was wide open.
just pick anyone else. Throw it at the guard.
And then the second one is, you know, I'm still a little more critical on German Green than some people are. I get that when you're recovering that punt, normally there's never a returner back at that spot. And so normally you do just look at the ball and you field it because that's how it goes. But you also have to have peripheral vision. Like you have to be able to see that there's a guy there.
They also had two guys behind the returner on the goal line that someone should have just been yelling at Green to GTFO.
Yeah. I mean, that was Iggy Brizdakis. Like I've just got blinders on and I'm just not paying attention to anything that's going on behind besides me. Because it was so bizarre. Like these two guys are fielding this punt and seem to have no idea that they're next to each other. And
that was a really weird play.
It was very strange. But that was it. I mean, outside of that, Michigan's execution in this game was 100%. I mean, you take those two things, that knocks it down to probably 96% for the total.
Well, that's
game,
what you said they needed to do. You just didn't get the turnover margin right.
I mean, that's the other thing. I would never have thought Michigan was going to outgain Ohio State.
Yeah, no. I mean, it would have had to have been a very low possession game for that to happen. But
and let me get my areas of I was right again here because I just do that every week. It's a thing that I
throw this in at the end of a 4-hour podcast. All right, how were you right this week, Alex? We'll make it into one of those bits.
So several things. First off, well, I'm going to revisit my preseason predictions. But,
I see.
This past week, I was on MGO Radio, and I said, I don't remember who said, you know, we have to hope to hold Ohio State to like 30, and I said, if Michigan holds Ohio State to 30 or less, they win the game. And Brian and Seth just started laughing. And I was like, I scouted this defense. I thought Michigan had a great matchup against Ohio State's defense. I thought if we were going to lose, it was going to be 63-31 or something. But
it's almost like you kind of know what you're doing.
So then
anyway,
my other
how else were you right?
My other one is my preseason predictions. Number one, Trevor Keegan will be Michigan's best offensive lineman. I don't think that's totally right, but it's not super far off, and he's been really good. So I claim that as a win.
Well,
never seen him before when I made that prediction.
When you have five offensive linemen that are all good and you don't know which one's the best, that's usually a good sign.
Generally speaking, yes. Unless you just have, like, Taylor Lewan, right?
Right.
And then you know who it is. But anyway.
What was the last one?
My second one, defense. David Ojabo will get all Big Ten votes. Brian and Seth started laughing and said next year.
Man.
Number three was the Big Ten one, which was Scott Frost will go 4-8 and will not be fired. It was actually 3-9 and was not fired.
You get laughed at too much, I think. Do I laugh at you?
No, not really. Same way.
I laugh at you because like you're short and you wear tank tops every week.